Welcome to Mending Fences, a podcast about effective ways to communicate and live with differences. I'm Patrice Bremner.
And I'm Jen Hawthorne. We're both family law mediators and collaborative law attorneys, but our conversations go well beyond family law. We explore the personal, interpersonal, legal, and cultural impact of conflict.
Hi, and welcome back to Mending Fences. I'm Patrice Bremner, and I'm here today with Jen Hawthorne Kelsey, as always. Hi, Jen.
Hi.
And we have a special guest today, a returning guest. We're here with attorney and mediator Karen Van Coy, who Jen and I spoke with, maybe a year ago. Anyway, we had such a great conversation. We wanted Karen to come back. And today, before we hit record, we've been talking about the importance of word choice and language in conversations related to dispute resolution, but really even beyond that. And we have a few examples of how just changing language can really, really affect the framing of a conversation, right?
Yeah, I think that's a great explanation of what we've been talking about, Patrice. And welcome, Karen.
Thank you. Glad to be back. Always a pleasure.
So one of the, we came up with like sort of four words or topics related to words that we want to touch on today. And the first one I'll just jump in with, and so these are, some of these are specific to resolutions of divorce or family legal matters. But I think as we get into the conversation, you'll start to hear that you can apply the idea, even if it's different terminology, you can apply the idea anywhere. The first one, let's talk about the word proposal. Is that a good place to start?
I think that's a great place to start because people often walk in to a mediation thinking that they have this whole, and I'll even up the ante a little bit and say an offer for the other person, which proposal might sound a little softer to people. But I think that folks often have a full positional detailed idea of what they want to see and an agreement. And the stronger they come in with this idea that this proposal is what the talking point should be, the harder it can be to have an actual conversation. So, you know, we've already started talking, but to share with our listeners, what are some words that could replace proposal that you two think successfully work with clients?
I would start with the image I have when someone comes in with that word is the tip of an iceberg poking out of the water. It's like they've already gotten to, here's my pointy, sharp proposal. And to try to get people to step back and realize there's this whole body underneath all these things that you're trying to address. And to make this process work, we need the space, the time, the language to explore what's underneath all of those, what I essentially think of as positions. I mean, you had said that. So where is a proposal, and where is it a position statement is the first way in for me when I'm talking with my mediation clients, or if I have a collaborative client that comes to me and says, here's my proposal.
So I weighing in on proposal as a word I shared with you, I think, already, that coming from a litigation background, proposal to me was an improvement over demand or offer. And so I thought proposal, it sounds a little bit lighter, like, oh, I'm just proposing this. I'm just putting it out there. I'm just proposing it. But I've learned that, and I really like the way you described it, Karen, is that it is just the tip of the iceberg because there's a lot underneath it. And now I've switched to talking about settlement ideas or settlement scenarios or sharing settlement thoughts so that it can feel like, and I've been able to find ways to work it into conversation so that it can sound like part of a larger conversation. We've not reduced something down to a proposed term sheet, you know, or something, but right. So it's not the pointy tip of the iceberg. It's, here are some thoughts about settlement. And usually, at least in a collaborative setting or a semi-collaborative setting, we might even include some rationale. Like, here's what I think would be a good idea. And here's some thoughts about why. And on that topic, I have been successful in cases over the last couple of years doing that and working with the other person's attorney ahead of time to vet what, you know, what I'm sharing so that they can see like, oh, some of this is going to be hard for my client to look at. Some of this will be really challenging. Let's find other language and come up with a written idea that is more palatable, maybe more digestible, and opens conversation.
Right. Like as I hear the word proposal, I think of instead of like the tip of the iceberg, what pops into my head is like a written document that there's such a strong urge to write a counter proposal to. And then it's exactly what Patrice was just saying, and Karen, you as well. You miss all of that discussion about everyone's needs, interests, and goals. You miss the opportunity to understand those. You miss the opportunity for option generation, brainstorming, evaluation as a group. And so you get so stuck in that positional back and forth potentially that I try to use the word, and I'm not always successful for sure. I try to use ideas, thoughts, and Patrice, I try if I'm working with another attorney to do exactly what you're suggesting and put in as much of that underlying quote unquote why explanation as I can for why whatever my client is suggesting is there, what's their rationale? You know, that way there's lots of space for not just talking about the actual idea, but for option generation.
Yeah.
That leads me to two separate thoughts that I want to put out there. One is, do you have a go-to example that you use with people that you're speaking with about this process? I would say clients, but we're going to discuss that one too soon. Where you show why we try to move away from positions to option generation and ideas. So for instance, there's the, you know, the two kids fighting over the orange and learning one wanted the skin and one wanted the juice. Or I used to, back in my litigation days, talk about things I had seen when people really said, I want to stay in the house. And then you would come flesh out, well, why is that? And you would come to understand, and everyone would come to understand, it was more about stability and ease of access to the community of friends that the children had, and that there were other ways that those goals could be reached. But I find it challenging in the beginning of a process to get the participants to step back and understand the value of all of that. Second piece I just want to put out, but we don't have to go to yet, is and even within the other ideas, I mean, the list, I had ideas, scenarios, thoughts, options, and I realized even then, some of them trigger option is kind of a binary, you know? So I really looking for languages that don't trigger any binary reaction.
It's a process. I mean, it's a process, and what's going to work in one situation won't work with the next set of people, or what works early in the process might not work later. And I think it's about being adaptive and always checking in with yourself. Like, have I slipped into positional framing? Have I slipped into, and I do it all the time and have to catch myself. Like I have a situation right now where I'm getting ready to draft something and I'm realizing that I'm tempted to say, well, we can do it this way or that way, pick one. And it's like, yeah, because I want to start, there's a tendency to want to start to narrow things down when we're still maybe needing to expand thinking. So
right.
I think it's just about being really conscious of it.
What I was going to say a minute or so ago is that I think that my favorite example is one that you were starting to use, Karen, which is house, the house versus a home. And most of the time when people are saying they want to keep the house, if you get into those reasonings underneath, it's often the idea of home. And that is so hard to leave for most people. And there's so much fear when there are still children in that home, that the children will have a hard time leaving that home and coming to any other location for living. But talking about that, there's so much room for talking about what makes a residence a home.
If we can, I would like to hopefully get to have enough time to talk about a couple other terms?
Yeah.
Is it okay? Mm-hmm. So another one that I think is really important for people to start to hear differently is mm-hmm. when we're talking about kids, the use of the term custody, which to me sounds like, it sounds like we're talking about a prisoner to me.
Yes. And actually, I think custody doesn't have as much of a trigger in my head as the word visitation. And before, Karen, I don't know if you just want to share what you were saying before we started recording about visitation. I thought it was perfect. That
very early on when we were shifting, when the courts were actually shifting away from the concepts of custody, I had one particular judge would always say, the only people that have visitation are prisoners and hospital patients. That's when visitation occurs. I do not want to hear about a parent having visitation. Yeah. And that always just really stuck with me and grounded me in expanding to parenting plan and decision making around children. And what I find not challenging, but I find it is part of the process, is describing that shift to the people that I work with, because the language in the statutes that we're working with still say custody, legal custody, physical custody.
Right. And so just to frame it so people can hear the difference is that that is, I think for a lot of people, still what sounds like the normal language, and it doesn't sound wrong. It sounds like, well, we need to determine custody. Like there's a complaint for custody. There's in the Massachusetts court, you can bring a complaint for custody if you're unmarried and you want to establish your parental rights. You have to bring a complaint for custody. But as Karen said, over years, and it's been many years now, we really have moved from physical custody to parenting plan. And we've moved from legal custody to decision making. And it is a conversation that's still one of the first conversations we have with folks, even after all these years. It's hard to let go of. And as a child of divorce myself many years ago, I was the subject of a visitation schedule, you know, and I had visitation with my non-custodial parent, you right. know, the lesser parent.
Right. And that's exactly why those words matter, right? Mm-hmm. Because what I often share with parents is you're a parent all of the time, whether your child is present or not. And I used this example actually, I think last week with clients. If you have a married family, a family where the marriage is still intact, and one of the parents travels for business and is gone much of a week, nobody ever suggests that that parent is not a parent while they're on their business trip. Yet for some reason, just because children are sleeping in another house, we change this language to custody and visitation and all of these words. Still about parenting. You're just managing who is making the decisions and when. And the big decisions versus the day-to-day decisions. That's what's really being talked about.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to the other one because I'm so curious about this one. I always refer to people as my clients.
Yeah, I clearly do. I have done it, I think, at least twice, if not three times already on this podcast.
So I started moving away from it over the last couple of years. And it took me a while to even start to question, like, why is that becoming uncomfortable? What don't I like about client? And I finally realize that it's referencing my business relationship to those people, whether they're clients in a mediation where there are two of them, or an individual client who I'm representing or working with in a collaborative case. It's a reference to my relationship to them, and it's not about their autonomy or agency in the process, which is what I want to foster. And so I've started thinking of them as participants. I'm trying to use that language more and more. So it's about them being in the process on their own steam and participating rather than in relation to me.
Yeah. So my internal reaction when you say that is, yeah, I use client all the time. And you're totally right. That is describing my relationship or the other professional's relationship to the folks we're working with. And they are participants in the process. And I'm wondering if we could go even further as a community and just, you know, they're also parents. They're also spouses or not, maybe they're former spouses, but they have relationships to each other too that has nothing to do with the process. And should we potentially start talking about and trying to internalize for ourselves just talking about their status as human beings and parents and spouses and whatever relationship we're helping them create as they go through the process. So co-parents or things of that nature.
Yeah, I definitely, when I'm drafting an agreement, for instance, I definitely reference them either by name or by parent, sometimes by spouse. But you're right, I don't do that as much in conversation.
Yeah, I try to do the same in drafting. Karen, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say, I've been noticing in my separation agreement, I often will have name, 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 parenthesis, hereafter, and then the person's name or the wife or the husband. And I leave that in, and yet I never refer to them as that. In right. the document, I always use their first name. So right. I need to go back, and it's just so ingrained.
Yeah.
Yeah, I ditched husband and wife a long time ago in favor of spouse or parent. But yeah, I don't know, Jen, what it would take as a community to start to, well, you know, I think it's happening in parts of the community, right?
To change that language? Yeah, it is. And even the courts, you know, we have a sample list from the Frisk Court, which is the Family Resolution Specialty Court, which unfortunately for those of us in Eastern Mass only exists in Western Mass right now. But it's a shift in the court process to try to soften the approach to parenting and to take the court terminology in part out and just to give more decision-making power to the parents as they're going through a divorce, very much like what we are trying to do in this out-of-court world that we're talking about all of the time. And so we were lucky to have someone present at an MCLC conference for us and share this list of language with us. But I think as a larger family law bar across the board, all attorneys could benefit from trying to make this language shift. And I think it would benefit society at large.
And I would go further and say, you know, listening to how you use language throughout your life.
Oh, sure.
And I've become conscious of, you know, when am I sounding positional? When am I sounding divisive unintentionally or exclusive? When am I taking a stand when I don't need to? And it could be, you know, in any setting. So we've talked about three terms. I don't think we have time for the fourth. We are a little bit over time, but do we want to touch on it really briefly?
Sure.
So traditionally in litigation, for those of us who litigated, we were attorneys and we had opposing counsel. And for me, that softened over the years to the other attorney. And I still stumble over it. I still stumble over it in a lot of settings. How do you talk about it?
I try to use other attorney, or if I'm talking directly to the person I am representing, I will say your spouse's attorney, or once there's an established relationship, I try to just use names to take that out. Because I think although in the collaborative process and in mediation representation, we're wearing our attorney hats, my personal opinion is that the people that do a really great job at this work still think of ourselves as a team when we are working on a case. And our collective goal is to make sure our individual clients are well represented, but to help them get to, and I've used this phrase 1,000 times, a practical, livable agreement. And that happens better when you think of the person on the other side as your teammate in getting your clients collectively, and see, I can't get away from clients, to a practical, livable agreement.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to have to circle back with you on clients because I'm attached to that. But with me, other parties' counsel is usually what I say. And I always liked that because I could still use the shorthand OPC.
Yeah.
That I used to use a lot, opposing counsel. But I too try to use the name or say the spouse's name and their attorney or their counsel.
I want to say that, you know, I've made a concerted effort over the last couple of years to really change some of this language, particularly around proposal and client, you know, and all this. And I really think it's helped. I think it's really made a difference in my communication with my colleagues, with my clients, and just the way I'm looking at it. It's changed the way I'm framing my thinking. I think it's effective.
Yeah, I agree. I'm sure there's a whole bunch of other examples we could think of to talk through. But for now, I think this conversation has reached its end, but we're definitely going to keep talking. And thank you, Karen, for joining us today. As always, I'm sure you'll be back for a round three at some point.
Thanks, Karen.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Jen.
Well, everyone.